This is Wilderness and Wildlife, presented by the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. This is a half-hour program featuring commentaries and interviews with wildlife and wilderness advocates relating to the unique natural environment that we enjoy in the wildlands of the West and across America. I'm your host, Jay Schell. Our guest today is John Horning, Executive Director of Wild Earth Guardians, based in Laramie, Wyoming. John grew up in Washington, D.C. on a street that borders Rock Creek Park, one of the wildest urban parks in our country, where he cultivated an appreciation for the solace of wild spaces. John graduated from Colorado College in 1989, where he developed a lifelong appreciation for the writings of Wallace Stegner. John has worked for a variety of environmental education and advocacy groups and moved to New Mexico in 1994, where he joined the staff of what would later become Wild Earth Guardians. What was it known as? Welcome, John. What was it known as before it was Wild Earth Guardians?
Well, originally it was Forest Guardians. We love the name Guardians. We love what it means to be a guardian, and we just decided that we'd outgrown the forest, and so we changed the first half to Wild Earth.
So are you actually in New Mexico or in Wyoming?
I'm in New Mexico, actually. Guardians was founded here in Santa Fe, where I am, but we've got offices scattered all across the West. Not one in Laramie, but we do have an office in Missoula, Denver, Boise, Seattle, scattered in this day and age, and a few other places in the West as well.
Well, on your website, I counted 35 staff members, including 11 attorneys. What's your primary activity? Is it litigation or lobbying, or what's field work? What's going on?
You know, legal advocacy has always been a cornerstone of Guardians' approach to defending wildlands and wildlife. I would say in the last decade, we've diversified our approaches to try and drive kind of deeper systemic change on some of the issues we're confronting, and that has led to more political, legislative advocacy, and of course lobbying,
right,
both at the state and federal level.
So you have a 4-star rating from Charity Navigator. How important is that to you?
Well, I think it's incredibly important. You know, I've been the executive director of Guardians for 20 years. I've been with Guardians for 27 years.
Uh-huh.
And when I first started, it was two people. I was the second person hired. And I think one of the reasons we've been able to grow is both impact, of course, and effectiveness, but also, you know, people want to know that you use their nickel well, and that means you got to run a tight ship. And the 4-star rating from Charity Navigator is an indicator that we are both focused on impact and focused on running a tight ship and using donors' dollars for the purpose that of protecting wildland and wildlife. You know, people are rightly concerned about the degree to which philanthropic dollars get used for the bottom line, whatever it is. And so, love that we've had a 4-star rating for as long as we've had it.
Ah, that's great. Yeah, because that's important to Charity Navigator, fiscal responsibility. So, congratulations.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
What's the big issue right now with you guys? Is it wolf litigation?
Wolf advocacy is front and center for Guardians, as it is with lots of groups. You know, I think ESA listing, Endangered Species Act listing, is one of the most highly visible ways of securing greater wolf protections. But I also think getting the federal government out of the business of trapping, snaring, and poisoning of wildlife is another piece of how we can protect not only wolves, but of course other native carnivores. So definitely wolves are front and center. We're also involved in all kinds of other endangered species protection efforts, from lynx. Just settled a lawsuit on lynx that's going to require the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to develop a recovery plan, and a bunch of other species as well.
Mm-hmm. So Montana and Idaho and, well, Minnesota now has a temporary moratorium on wolf hunting, but Montana and Idaho are still going great guns. Is that war on wolves being taking a lot of wolves out this fall?
You know, unfortunately, the sort of unvarnished truth is yes. The forces that are hostile to wolves are in control at the state level, and in Idaho and Montana in particular. And as I'm sure most of your listeners know, the state legislatures in both of those states have enacted new laws that the state wildlife agencies are charged with implementing that allow for basically a massacre of wolves. And we've already seen 70 some wolves in Montana. I'm not sure what the number is in Idaho, but you know, if Idaho and Montana fulfill the legislative sort of ceiling of wolves that are allowed to be killed, it could be up to, I think, 1,400 wolves just this season. So it's quite discouraging. It's pretty brutal. Uh-huh. And sadly, wolves have become a part of the culture war in our country. So I as much as I hate to admit it, I think it's going to be a bloody season this year.
Your efforts at litigation aren't working?
No, I mean, legal advocacy, like all kinds of advocacy, takes time. As you know, I'm sure, and listeners know, when the wolves were delisted last year by Trump, that wolf effort is in court. Hopefully we prevail. If we do prevail, depending on how the judge rules, it's not going to restore wolf protections in the Northern Rockies. Wolves in the Northern Rockies were stripped of their protections by Congress, and guardians and other groups have petitioned the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to take another look at whether or not wolves in the Northern Rockies deserve protection. That's what Congress said when Congress removed federal ESA protections. Of course, that's the only time in the history of the Endangered Species Act that Congress has removed a species from the endangered species list. So there are really two paths, both with the same outcome, which is restoring federal protections. Both of those paths are going to take time, so that there's not a whole lot of reason for being optimistic about this hunting and trapping season in both those two states. Now, it's possible that Deb Haaland, our Interior Secretary, could enact emergency protections for wolves, and that could restore protections all across the West. My sense of her and the Interior Department is that they're not likely to do that. And unless the number of wolves killed rapidly escalates, which could happen in Idaho because of the bounties that that Idaho is enacting and the amount of money that they're putting to the bloodshed. I mean, it's crazy. Again, it's like for individual wolves, the state of Idaho is awarding something like a minimum of $2,500 per wolf.
Jeez.
So it's really quite atrocious what is happening in those two states.
Yeah, and in the winter, wolves are easier to track in the snow, and they can be chased with snowmobiles. That's
it's crazy.
Pretty bad situation.
It's crazy.
Right.
Yeah, it's crazy. And the trapping seasons haven't even started yet. I know in Montana the trapping season starts either the 27th or the 29th. And, you know, when the trapping season starts, sadly, I think the body count will rise
right
exponentially.
Okay, well, let's talk about a lighter subject. How about the Northern Rockies Ecosystem Protection Act? You've been working on that. Does that have a chance?
You know, I think what we need to do is build a national constituency for protecting wild public lands, and we don't yet have that national constituency built. It's in many respects, while the sort of visceral and emotional dimension of wolves is very different from protecting wildlands in the Northern Rockies, the political dimensions are quite similar. And by that, I mean, just like there's hostility to wolves amongst the state legislatures and the congressional delegations in the Northern Rockies, so too is there hostility to bold land protection efforts. So I think the congressional route, which is the only route to secure long-term durable protections, is not likely in the short term. And again, just like we need to nationalize the issue of wolf protection and not cede the policymaking space to these states, we need to nationalize land protection, and that's the vision for how we get the Northern Rockies Ecosystem Protection Act across the finish line. Having more congressional sponsors on the bill, I know Carolyn Maloney and from New York, the representative, has introduced a bill in the House. But I think while we are building that national constituency, it's going to take time before we've got a stronger ground game in Congress to really think that we can get it across the finish line, because it's going to require overriding some of the local interests in both the Senate and the House, and that's not easy to accomplish.
Right, yeah, not these days. So, on your website, you talk about your objective in restoring wildlife, wild places, wild rivers for a healthy American West. How do you define the healthy American West?
You know, for guardians, health is grounded in the health and the resilience of ecosystems, the presence of dynamic ecological forces, whether fires in the right intensity and frequency, or floods, or the really critical presence of ecosystem actors who also bring dynamism to the land, like wolves, like beavers, like prairie dogs. These are, you know, historically, when I first got involved in the work, we called them keystone species. Now they're called highly interactive species or ecosystem engineers. And we can't have, or we don't meet the definition of healthy, resilient landscapes in the American West unless we have healthy populations of these critical ecosystem engineers. And you know, I believe in the intrinsic value of all species, and Guardian's work reflects that in terms of protecting some little-known stoneflies or chipmunks. And there are certain species, again, like beavers and prairie dogs and wolves, and even other species like sage-grouse that play critical roles in the health of ecosystems. And health of the region is, while grounded in an ecological lens, it's also grounded in a lens of human communities and And therefore also confronting the climate challenges that we face, which can't solely be confronted through a regional or even national lens, but, you know, we have to do everything we can to decarbonize our economy, lock down fossil fuels in the American West, and that is a tremendous challenge, not only economically, but of course politically as well. But we need to move as quickly as possible in bringing an end to the era of fossil fuel extraction in the American West. And that's a challenge from Montana to New Mexico, because these are states that historically have built regional economies, state tax revenues, and even local cultures on the fossil fuel extraction mindset. But, you know, relative to where we were 15 years ago, I feel optimistic in terms of the progress we've made. We still have a long, long way to go. So it gives you a sense of how we define health in terms of the health of the American West.
One of your objectives is to stop illegal grazing. How extensive is that, and what do you do to interfere with that?
It's pretty widespread. Livestock grazing, as again, I imagine you know and your audience knows well, is pretty entrenched throughout the American West, and some places more so than others, probably more of a problem on BLM lands than it is on Forest Service lands. But there's a long history of sort of, I would call it servitude, an attitude on the part of the BLM and the Forest Service of basically providing a service to the extractive industries, in this case, the livestock industry. And I think as grazing is perceived by both the agencies and also by the industry itself as a right, then even though it is a privilege to graze, to have a permit for public lands, the more it is an entrenched right with the cultural attitudes that build around that mindset, then the more prevalent sort of trespass grazing and illegal grazing and all of that is part and parcel of the problem. And in terms of how you deal with it, I will say not easy, because it's not just a cultural and a political problem. It's legal and institutional, and to take on those institutions requires a tremendous amount of persistence and energy and just relentlessness. And those are all qualities that, you know, most advocates like to think they bring to their work. And so I think it just requires a special degree of persistence and resilience when dealing with grazing. And so I spent about 10 years of my environmental advocacy career litigating on grazing for violations of the Clean Water Act, the Endangered Species Act, and the National Environmental Policy Act. And while we made tremendous amount of progress, it was not, it didn't drive the deeper systemic cultural and environmental change that I wanted. So we actually just have shifted in our approach. So now we're working on a very, very different approach. Instead of one in which we focus on sticks, we're focused on carrots. We're trying to pass federal legislation that would allow for grazing permittees to retire their grazing permits and to ensure that that action is permanent and durable. We need legislation. And so we actually just had legislation in New Mexico for all New Mexico's federal public lands, introduced about 6 weeks ago. And it's entirely voluntary. We've worked with a bunch of ranchers who are interested in this approach and kind of see it as a tool to allow their families to adapt and face the changing realities of kids not being interested or the economic challenges of beef production in a region where the climate crisis is having to reckon with that, the presence of wolves on the landscape. There are lots of factors that ranchers have to deal with today that, frankly, their parents or grandparents didn't have to deal with. And so I think it speaks to Guardian's sort of both nimbleness and creativeness in adapting to a challenging political landscape and a desire to facilitate broader cultural, political, and ecological change on a broad systemic basis.
We're running out of time, but I wanted to ask you about the border wall and what's happening there, what has happened, and what are you doing to try to recover?
You know, it's a disaster. It's a farce. Yeah, again, an example of how culture war in our country is both causing tremendous division, but also leading people to believe in strategies that are, I'm not even talking about ecological damage, but strategies that are not just wildly ineffective, but ridiculously non-viable. Like the idea that a wall on a scale on the grand scale in a rugged landscape with arroyos and rivers and mountaintops would prevent people from immigrating into the United States is just ridiculous. And so I actually feel badly for the land and for the wildlife whose migratory patterns have been disrupted by the wall. But I also feel badly for all the people who've been duped by Trump into thinking that a border wall would somehow address the perception and even the reality of a problem. And so that's, thankfully, you know, we no longer have Trump to deal with, at least not in the White House. And so much of the prospective damage has been stopped. Now there's a question of what to do about it all. And sadly, the billions, if not billions, at least hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars that have been wasted on this ridiculous project. I actually think creating a whole new border commission that looks at how to restore the ecological damage, because I think more people are understanding that the border wall was a political ploy and had nothing to do with really dealing with immigration policy. So
have you
lots of challenges there, and hopefully the damage that's been done can be undone, but not without a long-term vision about how the United States is going to relate to Mexico. And I think just one more thing on this, Jay. I think what we need is recognizing some binational, trans-border protected landscapes where both countries share a vision of wildland protection, that could be a unifying source of kind of alignment instead of the division that characterizes the border region.
So have you or any of your Congress representatives who are friendly to you, have they proposed the formation of this kind of a commission?
It's something that we've talked about with congressional allies in New Mexico. There's not, the conversation hasn't developed yet to the point of legislation being introduced.
Mm-hmm. So, have you identified sections of the border wall that are priority candidates for demolition?
You know, Guardians hasn't done that work. There may be some other groups that have, but Guardians hasn't.
Uh-huh. So Wildlife Services is a division of the Department of Agriculture that goes out and kills wildlife where there are rancher complaints. You're positioned to try to do what you can to curtail their activities. How successful are you doing on that score?
You know what? Actually, I'm quite optimistic. So I've been working on these issues for 30 plus years, and when I first started, the stranglehold that animal damage control had on sort of wildlife policy through the lens of animal agriculture was locked tight. And in the last 10 to 15 years, we've seen efforts in the political arena at the state level and in the legal arena at the federal level really result in radical changes to the methods, the tools, and the geographic scope on which Wildlife Services, aka Animal Damage Control, can operate. And in addition, just as an example, here in New Mexico, we, after 15 years of relentless political advocacy in the state legislature, we secured a ban on traps, snares, and poisons on all public lands, and that includes the activities of the Federal Animal Damage Control Agency. So lots of progress and still a tremendous amount of work to do, but again, I'm hopeful given both the progress we've made, some of which has been really heartening and durable change at the state legislative level, and I think the change in public attitudes is also heartening because more and more people want us to coexist with these magnificent animals. So heartened and hopeful is how I would describe my outlook.
Oh, okay. It's amazing how time gets used up so quickly. I have a lot more questions.
I know.
Maybe we can do another session, but we are out of time. So thank you very much, John. I appreciate it. Our guest today has been
John. You're welcome, Jay.
John Horning, Executive Director of Wild Earth Guardians. And this has been Wilderness and Wildlife, a presentation of the Gallatin Wildlife Association in Bozeman, Montana. To hear more of these half-hour interviews, go online to js-wilderness.com and see additional features of our website. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Jay Shell.